It is the soul moon energy which are forever causing it to build more noble mansions for itself. The soul, once it has begun this journey, becomes the reincarnating end. It becomes the gradually growing person in the body. And this person casts off worn-out bodies and takes others. And each time it is embodied, it is not the personality, but the soul which grows. It is not John Doe in his present life with his bank accounts and his debits and credits and his domestic difficulties that is the essential point. John Doe will go back to the earth, but the experiences through which he passed become part of the immortal wealth of the soul itself. So by degrees, this soul is attaining to a diversity of achievement. It is absorbing art and music and literature. It is becoming wise in sciences and gracious in artistry. It is becoming compassionate and loving, unselfish. It is seeking ever more the refinement of its own nature. It aspires to truth and causes the body gradually to become the servant of the psychic life within. Therefore, if we will say that the human being in the course of a certain number of physical lives, say roundly 800, passes through a great cycle, which is called the Earth cycle, these 800 lives together constitute the single lifetime of the soul. And the soul passes from infancy to childhood, and from childhood to adolescence, and from adolescence to maturity, and from maturity to age, over great periods of time. Because the soul is that part of man which must gradually accumulate and amass all of the infinitely diversified mystery of phenomena. It is that thing which, in order to be complete, must experience all things, must pass through every conceivable condition and state, and must therefore ultimately, it is said, release totally the potential of the divine seed which was planted in the beginning. For that which comes from deity and is hidden in nature is gradually revealed and released until it blazes forth in the fullness of its total accomplishment. This concept, then, is that within man himself grows, as Vaini called it, the soul plant that has its root in the heart and which continues to grow until it becomes a great and wonderful palm tree in the desert, marking the oasis, or the place where the waters of life forever flow. A very beautiful and poetic simile. If, then, the soul, representing the hypotenuse, proceeds at an oblique angle over the great cycle of periods of birth and death, while men pass from physical maturity to age and death and are born again, the soul advances gradually. Or as the philosopher Apuleius says, with a swaying and eccentric motion. The soul does not immediately ascend or descend, but continues in various conditions according to the relation of soul to body and body to consciousness. At the early periods of its life, or of its evolutionary growth, the soul in man is practically embryonic. It is merely preserved and protected within the body. Gradually it comes to be quickened, and finally, in the human being, normally speaking, it has been born. That is, it has come to an individual and independent existence within the life of man. From that time on, it must pass through all the stages with which we associate growth, whether a visible or of invisible thing. And in its courses of growth, it is in a state of more or less constant conflict with body. Not because body is bad, but because, as the Greek said, matter is an obscuration, an intoxication, a toxic association. And while the soul is completely within the control of body, it remains darkened and immature, for it must struggle for its survival against the encroachments of matter and of materiality in general. Now the soul, however, as it grows, does not grow immediately to perfection. For the soul in its early development is intimately associated with matter. Therefore, while it is in conflict with matter substantially, it is not in conflict with matter from the standpoint of experience. Primitive man, in his experience, used every native capacity that he had to attain the material objectives of his life. In other words, he used his skill in hunting and fishing, in outwitting his enemies, and in finding a place to live, in protecting his children, and gradually building a tribal or cooperative existence. Therefore, all of his psychic resources were objectified. And according to Pythagoras, what we call civilization is a pattern. And this pattern is the objectification of the soul into the environment of man. Thus, all external things are souls made flesh or made formal. Institutions, laws, codes, everything that we know is in some way an objectification of the mathematical formula of the soul, inasmuch as the soul is the archetypal image, the long shadow of which extends down into matter. But because it is a reflection, this shadow is distorted and imperfect, and not to be compared with the essential nature of the soul itself. There comes a time in the gradual growth of the individual when the soul, having matured, having gradually come to certain internal realizations of values as the result of experience and as the result of the lessons taught by conflict with environment, the soul begins to become a more and more integrated, organized, and dominant force in the character and temperament of the person. This means that ultimately, as Plato has pointed out, the soul becomes the teacher, inasmuch as the soul must overcome and civilize every body that it builds. The soul must gradually possess its body and take over the functions of body and direct body to the attainment of purpose. The greater the luminosity and power of the soul, the more useful and energetic the body will appear to be, inasmuch as the body's primary purpose is to serve as the instrument of the soul in the condition of matter. And the body has, therefore, no essential purpose of its own. It is that which must be moved, because it is the soul within it which is the self-mover. And we begin to appreciate this dimension of the Socratic and Platonic definition. The soul gradually gaining greater and greater ability and wiser understanding of things becomes ultimately the leader of life. The soul, therefore, ultimately takes over and gradually deflects or diverts the attentions of the body to the purposes of the soul. Samson, representing more or less the human soul, was blinded and bound to the millstone of the Philistines. Therefore, the soul, in this sense, is that which is blinded and bound to grind out the material life of the individual. And we use the power of the soul for every selfish and conceited purpose that happens to come to our minds. Little by little, however, the soul power matures. And it is the maturity of this power, which is an unbroken sequence of maturity, which actually results in the evolution of the species or the type. Man has an indwelling or individual soul. Lower kingdoms that we know have collective or group souls, which have not yet passed into individualization. Therefore, species and types have common patterns, with man as an individual pattern. And man is the only creature which is able, of its own will and accord, to violate the laws of its own being. Therefore, man alone, of all creatures known to man, is capable of sin. Because sin is a conscious violation of the laws of the spiritual code of life. And to have this power, man must have conscious individuality. The soul, by its various progresses and achievements, thus gradually unfolds the power of both spirit and matter, and draws within itself all of the essences of these things. For the essence of matter is experience, or soul power. And the essence which the soul accepts from God is consciousness, or intuitive apperception, by which the individual soul has a share or intuitive knowledge of its own origin and destiny. Therefore, we have the Gnostic hymn of the Robe of Glory, in which the so-called life journey of man is the soul seeking its own homeland, or the return to its own primary and eternal nature. In the Eastern systems of metaphysics, we have some interesting speculations concerning the nature of the soul. And these speculations include the concept of the adept soul, namely that when, through growth, through discipleship and the disciplines of the mysteries, the disciple reaches the point in which the body is finally mingled with the purposes of the soul, so that there is no longer a qualitative interval between body and soul, and personality has formed its ultimate and permanent union with individuality. And the external person has no life apart from or different from that of the soul. But then the two, the personality and the psychic nature, are blended. And therefore we have the assumption of the Virgin, or the Virgin Mother united forever in the glory of her child. In other words, we have nature or the earth restored in glory in the soul. For then the soul has absorbed from the body or from nature all of its elements and agencies and has restored them to glory within itself. These symbolical accounts lead also to the concept that at the end of the cycle of incarnation, the ultimate embodiment or physical incarnation does not die, but passes like Enoch into the union with the soul without death. Because at that time, the personality and the soul are so identical that the two are united in one inseparable union. At that time, however, it is the soul which triumph, and the union of the personality and the individuality is the union of the church and the Lamb, or the union of the body or the material constitution with its own psychic over-self. Thus it is said that certain patriarchs walked with God without death, because in this case they represented the final union of the personality and the soul. In the end, then, there has come a very strange and mysterious situation. The individual, believing himself to be a personal being, has gradually moved along, building within himself something that finally takes over, calling the Chinese philosophy the transcendent being. And this transcendent being ultimately becomes the self. And when the self and the transcendent being are one, then man shall know no more of sin or death. Because this same consciousness, if it is captured consciously, becomes an unbroken continuity for the length of the life cycle. The psychic significance, therefore, is that out of two elements is born an imperishable third principle. And this imperishable principle has a survival in itself, absorbs the polarities into itself, and becomes an immortal being, represented by psyche, or represented by any of the ancient symbols used for that purpose. In the Egyptian ritual of Isis, the number 4, and Osiris, the number 3, by their squares, constituting 25, become identical with the square of Horus, the Beloved. In other words, they, in their union, form an exact equivalent, so that the soul, in its maturity, is the absolute and exact equivalent of the sum of heaven and earth. Psychologically, it becomes identical with these elements. And these elements, therefore, in their absolute blending, according to wisdom, will result in the imperishable rose diamond of the Hermetic philosophers, the homunculus, the crystal being, born, as the Hindu says, of will and yoga. This entire concept does give us a clue to the fact that Pythagoras was well acquainted with the Eastern doctrine, and also that he was skilled in the learning of the Orphics and those other mystics of that region and adjacent areas, including Persia and Babylon, where all these teachings had already been long established. So let us consider this symbolism just a little bit further. We have identified heaven and spirit, earth and matter, man and form. We have recognized also that when we say man, we actually are using the word manas, which means in Sanskrit, the thinker. And in this, the actual word man means mind. Therefore, that the fulfillment of man means, in some mysterious way, the fulfillment of his mental power. Now, let us consider mind now as an equivalent of form, because we're dealing with, again, the square of 5, and we have to see where this will lead to. We have already conceived from the level of soul that soul is gradually absorbing all experience into itself. The soul absorbs experience. The mind absorbs something else. The mind absorbs knowledge. Now, knowledge is not essentially different from experience in origin. because experience gives birth to knowledge, and knowledge is the report and record of experience. But then creatures have reached a degree of gradual mental unfoldment. Knowledge implies the transmission of certain facts on an intellectual level. It means that the individual increases in knowledge and learning, not always directly from experience, but from authority, from tradition, and from numerous records which are available to him. Learning, therefore, is a kind of vicarious kind of experiencing. It is a benefiting from the experience of others in the process of the unfoldment of our own capacity. It would obviously seem, then, that man's mind has a natural bent, and we can see this bent constantly in his inclination. So today, particularly at this period in our growth, we observe man reaching out mentally in an effort to grasp the universe, in an effort to circumscribe, bind, and hold all things to himself. The mind of man is seeking, and has always sought, to explore and capture the infinite. The mind of man seeks the victory over the unknown, and the unknown, in this case, is the entire mystery of creation itself. Thus mind, by its growth, is seeking to eat up the unknown, to transform it into the known, and through this, gradually to become master of all things. Thus mind, again, becomes a symbol of archetypal form. It becomes a symbol of another phase of man's life, of this struggle against limitation, this escape from bondage, this orientation of self in space, which actually is one of the great psychic problems. Mind, as with man, moves objectively as science and subjectively as philosophy. And these motions, either by phenomena, by fact, on one level, or by reason, or intuition, upon another level, the mind is seeking also to bind the opposite and to free itself from the mysteries of both heaven and earth. This, again, is a symbol of man as soul gradually gaining ascendancy over polarity and achieving victory over the unknown. Form, mind, man, all these terms also suggest within themselves organization. The formative principle is therefore organization in itself. The universe consists of the divine power immovable, and material or circumference obscurity which is moved but has no motion of itself. And in between these, the self-moving agent, which is archetype. Therefore, to the Pythagoreans and the Platonists, archetypes are living patterns. Patterns which are self-moving and are therefore capable of an adjustment with matter. They are capable of moving matter and also of moving themselves. Archetypes are the basis of growth, and there are two kinds of archetypes in the ancient symbol. One is the great collective archetype, which in the Pythagorean concept is composed or consists of the number 50. Now it will be observed that 50, by some mysterious law, is analogous to the 50 paths of the Kabbalah. In the Kabbalah, there are 50 gates or roads which lead to the ineffable. And it was said in the ancient Jewish law that the secret behind the fact that Moses was not able to enter the land of Canaan was because this land represented the 50th gate, and Moses was only able to pass through 49 gates, the square of 7. The 50th gate was reserved for the Messiah, the one who was to come, who alone could pass through the last of the gates. Now, if we remember for a moment, we will remember that the square of 3 plus the square of 4 plus the square of 5 equals 50. Because we have the 3 and the 4 equaling 25, the square itself of 5 equaling 25, and the sum of these equaling 50. Therefore, these 50 represent the great and complete number, or the complete cycle, 0 added, of the number 5. 5 and the sign of the cycle is 50. In these principles of 50, we also have two peculiarly equal symbols, because we have two numbers, 25. One, the square of 5, and the other, the squares of 3 and 4 together. So that we have an identity established here, which is important. The square of 3 and 4 equals the square of 5, and by their union, they produce it. The square of 5, in turn, fulfills the square of 3 and 4. And by the union of these three, the number 50 is released into objectivity. And 50, of course, is 5 extended to 10 cycles of itself, or 10 times 5. And 10, of course, is the basic tetractys itself. The 10 revolutions of the 5, then, or cycles of the 5, are here implied. But for our purposes at this moment, let us remember that we can go back to our idea of the 6 sticks, which ceased to be 6 separate sticks and bring into existence the compound number 6. The union of the 3 and 4 in their squares produced 25, which is the archetypal pattern of the soul. Therefore, the inevitable mingling of consciousness and matter in the ratio of 3 to 4 results in the spontaneous release or generation of psychic life wherever it may exist. Thus, the 3 plus the 4 equals psychic release. And whenever this energy or this formula imposes itself upon any area of space, the psychic potential of that area is released into objectivity. In other words, a psychic life is born. Because this psychic life is exactly equivalent to this union of the divine nature and its own circumference, or the material deprivation of itself. In turn, also, the number 5, or psychic life, when it is fulfilled, becomes identical with God and nature. Therefore, the perfect soul is restored to the number 25, and therefore becomes identical with the nature of God and nature. Thus, God and nature combine and conspire to create the soul, and the soul in itself, when it is complete, is identical in its totality with the causes which produced it. Thus, there are two ways of achieving the number 25. One, by the union of the 3 and 4 and their squares, the other simply by the square of 5 itself. This tells us something else about the nature of the soul. Namely, that while the soul is a compound, it is also a totality. Therefore, the soul has the power for perfection without generation. This is important and is the reason why in the ancient story of the phoenix, which was the symbol of the soul, the phoenix, there was only one in the world at the time, and it gave birth to itself from itself. And was similar in the symbolism, therefore, to Melchizedek, king of Salem, the mysterious priest who first administered the Eucharist to Abraham, and of whom it was said he was his own father and his own mother. And later, St. Paul likens Christ, saying that he is a priest forever, after the order of Melchizedek. Thus Melchizedek becomes the soul symbol, the phoenix, because it is capable of achieving the completeness of itself without generation. Therefore, it must be generated. But having once come into existence, continues forever without generation. This is, as you see, because of the way in which the 47th proposition brings it into existence. Namely, that it is generated from a three, from the square of the three and the square of the four. But of itself, it is the totality of the sum of these squares. Therefore, for the perpetuation of itself, it requires no further generation. Because the 25 is the symbol of the psychic field in its own nature. Thus the soul, once created, becomes the hermetic androgene. And the soul, as the modern psychologist knows today, is androgynous, inasmuch as it is the product of the union of polarities. In the ancient Jewish system, the Adam Kadmon, the original prototypic Adam, was actually this psychic androgene. And the division within the soul into its intellective and emotional parts is represented through the creation of Eve, which is a psychic polarity within the soul, or the division of the soul substance into its natural polarities, the anima and the animus. But in itself, the soul is androgynous, because it contains both the principles of the square of three, which is male, and the square of four, which is female. Therefore, it is in its own nature the symbol of the hermetic being, the androgynous Mercury. And why is Mercury used in alchemy for this purpose? The answer being that it is the universal solvent. For Mercury accepts into itself all other substances, or was so believed to do, and reconciles them in its own nature. Thus the soul, in the ancient Hermetic writings, is said to accept into itself heaven and earth, and to bring them to peace. And in the great conflicts of the universe, sulfur and salt are reconciled by Mercury in the Hermetic allegory. And fire and water are reconciled in the mysterious Hermetic vessel. Hermes, of course, the Egyptian form and Greek form of the Latin Mercury, is himself or itself a personification of the soul. Therefore, it is said that Hermes was the author of 5,000 books, meaning actually that all writings come from the soul. Therefore, the psychic self is the author of all books and the master of all arts, the source of all learning. The soul self is also the teacher. For as the scales of evolution tip, a man moves towards being a soul-moved being. The source of his instruction and information and life come from within himself, rather than being imposed upon him from without. The soul being is therefore the teacher, the guide, the leader, the sage, the arhat, the mysterious mahatma of Indian legendary and lore, the great self. For the word mahatma itself merely means great soul. And it is the soul greatness in man which also bears this relationship. Thus the soul in its own achievement has been born of polarity, but is not essentially in its own nature polarized. And because it is able to bring a synthesis to polarity, it is capable of a divine apperception that is impossible in divided natures. All parts of man are polarized except the soul, which is only polarized in its generative expression. Actually, within the individual, the psychic life is gradually moving towards a complete equilibrium. And in this equilibrium, when it is attained, the psychic life will have a complete participation, or a balanced participation, in the universal mystery. Equilibrium, in this case, becomes the requisite for internal mystical or soul sight, or knowledge, or apperception. Now, in the Chinese concept of the transcendent being, which is produced by meditation and power within the self, the soul is seen to journey, like the Taoist genii and fairies, out from the body and to travel about in space, floating on a cloud, and often represented in a most comical and delightful manner. It flies about on cranes and birds, and it swims around the sea on the back of fishes and turtles. It really has a wonderful time, all wrapped up and apparently in a great cloth, robe, or mantle, with a very pixie-like expression. It scampers about the world, exploring everything, solving all mysteries, and of course forever searching for the peach of longevity, the mysterious symbol in Chinese alchemy of the philosopher's stone. And perhaps it has to go to the mysterious rabbit who guards the moon in order to find the tree of everlastingness. But all these legends and symbols have to do with this mysterious psychic self, which the Oriental does not regard as a heavy, burdensome spiritual reality, but rather as a delightful and wonderful creature, filled with the love of life and of living, wise and witty and thoughtful, and nourished, of course, upon the most ethereal and delightful of diets. Nourished on things far more wonderful than any food that man has in the material world. Of course, the same kind of food which is referred to in the New Testament, where the Master says, "I have bread ye know not of." The soul, therefore, lives on a nutrition of several kinds. It lives from experience. It lives from space. It lives from the supersensuous atmosphere, which extends beyond and around man. It lives in idealism, on truth, beauty, hope. It passes through innumerable moods, growing from doubts to certainty. The soul is not always wise, nor was it always good. The soul is not perfect, but it is infinitely wiser than the body which it inhabits, because it was there long before the body, and has the intuitive knowledge of bodies gained from great living. The soul may be wrong, and at some stages of its evolution it is selfish and benighted. But the gradual motion of it is toward a maturity which cannot be captured in the concept of any one embodiment or life. Now the Chinese, the Buddhists, the Hindus, and some of the Greeks, and some of the Persians, and some of the Muslims, also agree on something else, namely that in each embodiment of the individual there is a time somewhere in life when body and soul come the nearest together. In other words, there comes a time when the body more or less perfects or completes the experience which the soul can bestow at any given time into one pattern or situation. Only a small ray or part of the psychic self can enter embodiment at one time, because long before this period in our growth, the soul has become a so many splendored thing that you couldn't possibly lock it within one body. It is therefore, we will say, something of this nature. Suppose the psychic self has gradually intensified within its own experience over many lives the concept of music. And so it's in its embodiment or in its body, it inevitably lures or leads the personality toward the appreciation and practice of music. And let us suppose what is not always to be supposed, namely that the body cooperates, which in itself is quite an achievement in most cases. And that environment makes this possible, for many elements must come in. If this music is not achieved by the soul, there will be psychic stress and pressure, and we will begin to develop abnormalities, which are conflicts between the psyche and the body, or the personality. But assuming that the soul has its way in this, and that the individual does become a musician, and learns and studies and achieves a degree of virtuosity, there must and does come a time when the body has received all that the soul can confer in that particular. In other words, the body can carry on and follow the soul to a certain point in the achievement of knowledge. Then the body and the soul must grow together, because neither one of itself goes any further. At this point, the soul ceases to become the direct instructor of the body and must become a fellow seeker with it. And sometimes it is necessary for the body to take the dominant position and go out and gain experience or knowledge for the further enrichment of the soul. So there is a kind of partnership between these two parts of man's nature. And we come to a time which many persons have experienced and have seen in others, where it seems that the resources in a direction are exhausted. The young child can go to school for a certain number of years and then it just doesn't learn anymore. An individual goes to a certain level in his business and there he remains, because he is either afraid to take a further step or lacks certain abilities and capacities necessary for it. Thus there comes this time when the energies of the soul are no longer sufficiently specialized to advance the purposes of the body. Well, we must remember, of course, that the purposes of the body are only one of the concerns of the psychic nature, and therefore it may not, in all cases, be adequate to them. Then the psyche must grow. So from that point on, the internal life of man, again, requires experience and must accept new instruction. And there are persons to whom such instruction is possible. And there are others who, because of egoism and because of the failure to recognize the needs of the psychic life, stubbornly try to force their way and come to trouble. That is the reason why all human beings are not suitable to be doctors or lawyers, and why each level of humanity, and each, for that matter, every racial level, every religious and cultural level, every social level, represents the leveling off of the relationships between the psychic nature and the personality. This is the basic reason behind the Indian caste system, although gradually it was perverted until it showed very little similitude to the original idea behind it. Thus the psychic life has to grow also. It grows by new experience, and at the same time it teaches from old experience. Thus we find human beings wise in some matters and not so wise in others. And we find an infinite diversity of attainments and levels of attainments, even within the personality. So that in some things the individual has sound judgment and in others he has not. These represent the totalities of experience patterns as they react. Now there also are times in which the psychic life impels the personality to activities which the body is incapable of sustaining. And we find, therefore, conflict and inconsistency. We find also that under certain conditions, man has a general sense of soul power without coordinated means of manifesting this. And as a result, he may develop delusions of grandeur. He may become a dictator, not because he really wants to dictate, but because of the pressure of the power of psychic life over material obstruction. All these elements and factors the Greeks took into consideration in their very elaborate studies of man's psychic nature. And for these reasons, they are definitely entitled to be regarded as the true inventors and discoverers of what we call psychology today. They were already working with a very noble and wonderful concept of soul and soul power. As might be assumed or suspected, a basic diagram like your 47th proposition may be extended diagrammatically, symbolically, philosophically, and mathematically into many, many different departments of life. Pythagoras declared that in everything that you study, in everything that you think about, in every problem that faces you, first of all, triangulate. In other words, find your three essential points. For everything in the universe moves from three points, or assumes three relations among the parts of itself, and also occupies three dimensions in relationship to other things. Thus, to triangulate any mystery is to approach its solution. For three, in the form of triangulation, is the solution of everything, because three is the immutable nature of being itself. Those of you who have traveled extensively, perhaps, among primitive peoples, and we'll recognize that while among many civilized nations, the Trinity has become a very positive number of divinity, where peoples live close to nature in a primitive or aboriginal relationship, the number four is nearly always associated with God. Your Hopis, Navajos, and Zunis of the American Southwest represent God by the number four and by a square. They consider the earth to consist of an area bordered by four sacred mountains, which are the abodes of the gods. They have four directions of space and four sacred colors. And in almost all of their diagrams, either the square or the cruciform appears as a divine symbol. Therefore, we may say that those creatures close to nature, arising from the study of natural phenomena, nearly always have recognized and worshipped the number four. These same people have peculiar veneration for the Earth Mother. And wherever you have matriarchal religion, you have the psychological implication of the number four. And let us not forget that matriarchal religion is one of the earliest forms, and that for many thousands of years, most of the world was ruled by matriarchal systems, long before the patriarchal systems even came into existence. In Egypt, for example, the entire descent through the entire dynastic period of Egypt was on the side of the mother and not on the side of the father. And it was always among the brood families and among most of the primitive peoples of the world, the matriarchal system was supreme. And wherever it was, God was represented by the number four, by the cross or the square. Later, in more highly civilized cultures, where the archetypal designs began to change within the psychic life of man, the shift from the square to the triangle took place, or from the four to the three. But the four and the three did represent the primary manifestations of deity in substance or in essence. Because deity as three was to the Pythagoreans, remember the one and two, they did not consider to be basic numbers. To them, the one and two were principles, and three and four were the first numbers. Therefore, 3 and 4 stood in the place of 1 and 2 as symbols of unity and diversity. And in the Pythagorean concept of number, the 3 represented the concept of a divine totality of creative power. And 4 represented the manifestation of that power in the sphere of existence. God in nature was 3, in manifestation was 4. Therefore, the 4 was merely the objectification of the 3 out of its own nature. So that in the Egyptian rites, it is said that Isis was not only the wife of Osiris, but also his sister, his mother, and his daughter, bearing all relations. Because actually, Isis was merely the deity made manifest through the great objectification of its power. Therefore, the unmanifested, by union with the manifested, produces that which is in some things manifest and in some things not manifest, the soul. So the soul possesses or contains within itself the attributes of that which is manifested and not manifest. It contains the combination of that which is immovable and that which can only be moved. Therefore, it is said to be self-moving. It is in turn moved by the immovable cause of itself and imparts motion to that which is less than itself. In the soul, consequently, we have the manifested attribute of these primordial patterns. And these primordial patterns are set forth in your angle of the hypotenuse. This line also, ascending by an acute angle, incidentally further recognizes or testifies to the gradual ascent of the soul, which advancing upon a surface gradually achieves a summit. For without ascending directly, it reaches the top. And without descending directly, it reaches the bottom. Therefore, the motion of the soul was to the Egyptians likened to the various inclination of the poles of planets. For according to them and to our present consideration, the various inclinations of planetary poles indicate the life and development upon those planets. And if the inclination of the Earth's axis changed a few degrees, our entire way of life would be totally altered. Thus, this inclination of the psychic axis determines to a degree the relation of the soul, producing a night and day of the soul by an inclination of its axis, producing also sleeping and waking, which are equivalent to day and night, and producing also seasons within the soul, as Plato tells us. So that the soul has its winters and its summers, that it has within man a total astronomical existence, based also upon Pythagorean mathematics. And that finally the soul, in all of its effulgency and beauty, is actually the perfect dodecahedron, the most perfect of all the symmetrical solids. And as this is the fifth solid, and Pythagoras was the one who discovered in his time that there are only 5 symmetrical solids, or were known in his day to be only 5, and that the dodecahedron was the most perfect of these solids, being associated with the hierarchical number 12. But that this was the design or figure of the soul, and that by the interlacing of various mathematical forms, these solids were generated. And these solids, because this is the fifth solid, was called the quintessentia, or the fifth essence, or the fifth element. And Paracelsus von Hohenheim, of course, the alchemist, said that this fifth element was azote, the universal agent. And when he was asked what it was, he said it is the agent which combines the four elements, earth, fire, air, and water. On the level of science, this agent is called ether, the permeator, the hypothetical medium. And in man, this etheric essence is the psychic life which binds the body of the elements and is supreme over them and is the fifth Veda of India, the secret book of soul control. All this number, therefore, combines again into the number five, which is the soul itself. And the five powers of the soul are the sensory powers known to man. And the symbol of the soul was a five-pointed star. And this star was supposed by Agrippa and even Leonardo da Vinci to be composed or to be made of the five extremities of the human body. So that the individual standing spread eagle, his head, arms, and legs formed a five-pointed star. This star, of course, was the symbol of the psychic integration in man. The star is nearly always associated with the Messiah, and the star is also associated with the psychic currents within the human body. The five-pointed star is the symbol of health or of healing among the Pythagoreans, because soul is the eternal position, and that in which the soul is so placed that it is the upright five-pointed star cannot be subject to evil. This was also the protection against evil, for when placed upon the foot place of a door or upon the jamb of a door, immediately prevented evil spirits from entering. You'll remember the Blyfoot cross, as it was called, which appears in the story of Faust. He had this drawn upon the doorway of his room, and Mephisto could not enter until the five-pointed star was turned so that the one point did not face him. Having entered, Mephisto then found that to leave he must again face the one point of the reverse star. He could not go, and Faust taunts him by saying, "Why through the chimney not withdraw?" And Mephisto answers, "For gods and demons, 'tis the law, wherein they came, they must withdraw." And so we have the story of this mysterious five-pointed star, which, of course, is the symbol of the soul, and is a repetition of the hypotenuse, or the number five, in connection with the 47th proposition. Thus we find that this proposition, in substance, is the story of the soul, and as such, gives us perhaps a little clearer understanding of what the ancient meant by this term. It was this growing up of a consciousness within body, a consciousness derived from man's contact with environment, the gaining a certain knowledge of himself. For it is by this knowledge which is earned by the sweat of his brow, and not this knowledge bestowed upon him by heaven, that man earns his place in the universal plan. Man must earn his own salvation, and the means of earning is through the powers of the soul. And the soul, therefore, finally in its completeness, blazes out as the mysterious pentagram or five-pointed star. And wherever it shines, there is a symbol that the perfect soul is born, that the messianic soul is created within man, and therefore that the mystery of the redemption is by the Christ in you, the hope of glory. And this Christ within is the Christian exposition of the mystery of the psychic self. For this Christ is the messianic soul, the oversoul, in which we find the power, which if it be raised or lifted up, shall draw all other things unto it. And this mystery is so beautifully set forth in the Pythagorean Theorem, that I think it is well worth our meditation until next week.